You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
In the chapters right before today's Romans passage, Paul gives a list of what we should do to live a Christian life. In this chapter, he says what we shouldn't do. He makes an appeal back to the list of shall nots in the Ten Commandments. But he couches it in interesting terms. As he's been talking about money in the previous passage, he carries on with the same metaphor and says, "Owe no one anything but one thing." And what do you think that one thing is?
Our words of wisdom are from Romans chapter 13, verse 8 through 10. Owe no one anything except to love one another, for the one who loves another has fulfilled the law.
The commandments: you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and any other commandment are summed up in this word: love your neighbor as yourself.
Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Over the past year, national conversations about what you might have assumed were bedrock American values have become part of an Orwellian parade of reversals, where black is white and up is down. There have been so many examples, you might have missed the fact that this very weekend is part of that assault. On November 25th, 2025, while most of the country was distracted by Thanksgiving, President Trump signed an executive order that, starting tomorrow, MLK Day will no longer be a fee-free day in the national parks. It also removed the allegedly woke Juneteenth as a fee-free day, and to add insult to injury, added in their place Trump's own birthday, June 14th, as a fee-free day. Make no mistake, these changes lean in to the white Christian nationalist narrative of grievance and weaponize park fees as part of the broader debate about which stories our nation chooses to remember and which ones it sidelines. Which is why, as a Jesus follower, I like to keep the debate alive as to whether we should continue to celebrate Columbus Day. Given what we now know about Columbus, even the most ardent Knight of Columbus should feel ashamed, and no self-respecting Christian anywhere should stand for his name being honored in any way. About the best we can say of him is that he was a cheapskate. On his 1492 voyage, he promised a reward to whoever spotted land first. Hooray for sailor Rodrigo de Triana, right? No, Columbus claimed he had seen a glow the night before and gave the reward to himself. Who else does that sound like? Columbus was a heartless slave trader who, in order to lessen the failure of his having not found a new trade route, enslaved whole peoples. And because the Catholic Church forbade the enslaving of Christians, Columbus made sure not to baptize any of the natives. He not only murdered countless indigenous people, but also dealt in child prostitution, giving his sailors the perk of 9- and 10-year-old girls for their amusement. His reputation was so grim that rather than face whatever torture he had in store for them, many natives killed their children and then committed suicide. Columbus's contemporaries despised him. As governor on Hispaniola, he was a despot who kept all the profits for himself. He was so loathed by the colonists whose lives he controlled that multiple attempts were made on his life. At one point, he was actually arrested and sent back to Spain in chains for crimes against humanity. Good thing he was able to convince a desperate king and queen of the promise of more gold and gain himself a pardon for his crimes. But now, look around. We're stuck with universities, companies, networks, rivers, and whole countries named after this guy. But resistance to, or at least embarrassment over, the celebration of a Columbus Day is growing. Because any fairy tale people might have held on to about him has been eclipsed by the reality of the inhumanity he visited upon his fellow humans.
But come on! He was a Christian! Imagine how bad he would have been if he wasn't following Jesus!
If you remember last week's message, it seems pretty clear that Jesus' whole message was, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. It begs the question, how do we get from Jesus to Columbus, or from Jesus to Jim Jones, or from Jesus to Project 2025 and white Christian nationalism? Well, we're all products of our times, our environment, our genetic makeup, aren't we? A part of our problem is that for many, Christianity isn't about compassion and caring. It's about beliefs, buildings, and territory, which is troublesome, especially if you agree with the Dalai Lama, who said, "The purpose of all major religious traditions is not to construct big temples on the outside, but to create temples of goodness and compassion inside, in our hearts." Sounds good, right? But not so easy, especially when the church has so much to lose by not using guilt and fear to control what's inside our hearts. Dave Tomlinson, author of How to Be a Bad Christian and a Better Human Being, tells the story of working as a chaplain in a hospital that was treating people with HIV and AIDS. There he met Brian, an elegant gay man in his early 50s. Dave shares, quote, "He was about to go home for the weekend, but asked if he could meet me first. Brian was troubled by a recurring sense that God hated him for being gay. He grew up a Catholic, and despite having embraced the gay lifestyle and having lived with a partner whom he adored for 20 years, Brian never managed to dump the belief instilled in him as a teenager that homosexuality was a mortal sin. Now, faced with the prospect of meeting his maker sooner than later, the feeling that God rejected him tormented Brian." Dave goes on, "I reassured him that he was a beautiful human being, that God was proud of him, just as his friends and family were proud of him. I said that the only thing I could think of that God would hate was his guilt at loving his beloved Michael as he did. It was an uphill battle. We agreed to chat further after the weekend. But Brian never returned. He'd taken his own life." Dave was devastated and furious that such misery was inflicted in the name of a loving God. How different Brian's life might have been had he known acceptance and grace in the context of the church. At his funeral, Brian's distraught mother railed against the religion that had tormented her son. "Why did you do this to a man whose heart was filled with love?" she cried. "Why did you crucify my beautiful son?" The irony in her words seeped into my soul, said David, as I heard the voice of God calling from the heart of a grieving mother. It's been exactly that kind of condemnation and exclusion that has not only driven many people out of the church, but fired the passion and vision for so many of us to become bad Christians, advocating for an inclusive church, offering unconditional love, and celebrating our differences. Make no mistake, there is nothing more fundamental to Jesus' message than love and acceptance. And in today's passage, Paul reminds the Romans that the commandments are summed up in just five words: love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law. And if you want to know what that looks like when it stops being theory and is lived out in the world, we don't have to imagine. We've seen it. One of the preeminent American expressions of Romans 13 was Martin Luther King Jr. He didn't talk about love as niceness or civility. Like Paul, he talked about love as a moral obligation. In his Strength to Love, King wrote that love is the only force capable of transforming an enemy into a friend. And it wasn't sentimental. It disrupted lunch counters. It filled jails. It absorbed blows without returning them. Because for King, love was not how you felt about your neighbor. It was how far you were willing to go to make sure your neighbor was no longer harmed. King didn't ask whether love was practical. He asked whether anything else had ever worked. Love is not extra credit for Christians. Love is the whole assignment. So, how do we love our neighbors as ourselves?
Easy. By singing hymns, doing religious things, and saying lots of prayers.
Newsflash. Even the Bible says that God detests such things, especially when the so-called worshipers are at the same time oppressing the poor, finagling their personal finances, and perpetrating injustice. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Before white Christian nationalism became so popular for many politicians, the loudest voices invoking Christian faith and values in government were actually disciples of the philosopher Ayn Rand. You may know her reputation as the darling of libertarians everywhere, advocating a law of selfishness over love and commanding her followers to think only of themselves, not others. Author Stephen Prothero has written, "I don't agree very often with the Watergate criminal and evangelical leader Charles Colson, but he was right when he refers to Rand's idolatry of self and selfishness as the antithesis of Christianity." Colson says, "Christians cannot support both Rand's philosophy and Christ's teachings. The choice is simple. Ayn Rand or Jesus Christ. We must choose one and forsake the other." Why? Because Jesus said, "Love your neighbor as yourself." And Paul wrote, "If it hurts your neighbor, don't do it." Love is the fulfillment of the law.
But love is really hard.
Okay, well, don't forget that love isn't an emotion. It's a choice. It's an act of the will, a decision to work for the well-being of the other person, even when it means risking our own well-being. As Dave Tomlinson says, love is not about pink fluffy feelings. It isn't even necessarily dependent on liking the other person. And while America is not, by any stretch, a Christian nation, Puritan leader John Winthrop had a vision for the future of what was to become America that was solidly Bible-based. He would be mortified at the greed and rugged individualism that has come to define America. He envisioned a community committed to caring for one another's needs. For this end, we must be knit together in this work as one. We must entertain each other in mutual affection. We must be willing to abridge ourselves of our superfluities for the supply of others' necessities. We must uphold a familiar commerce together in all meekness, gentleness, patience, and liberality. We must delight in each other, make others' conditions our own, rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together, always having before our eyes our commission and community in the work, our community as members of the same body. So, the Puritans, immigrants, I might add, believed that we should all be in this together. And it's not just the opinion of some damned foreigner come here with their woke ideas. It's essentially echoing Jesus and Paul. In loving our neighbor, we express our love of God. But love of neighbor is still too complicated for Australian theologian Michael Morwood. He distills it down into just two words: be neighbor. That's it. There's action implied, not just some sentimental platitude or feeling, but a deep sense of covenant relationship that is made real in our actions, in our struggles for justice, in our very being. Be neighbor, not just waving to Wanda McGillicuddy next door, but to recognize the shared humanity and divine spark in others, and treating your neighbor with the same inherent value you place in yourself. You probably don't willingly let yourself go hungry. You clothe yourself reasonably well. If you can, you make sure there's a roof over your head. You try not to be cheated or injured. You, your neighbor. Same difference. Now, Methodists have a reputation these days of being nice. But that's not always been the case. On behalf of their neighbors, Methodists have been responsible for a lot of civil unrest over the years, fighting for laws that brought an end to child labor in this country and in Europe, and establishing unions for the betterment of working people's lives, often against unjust treatment from their Christian bosses. In Living the Questions, Painting the Stars series, our poster child is Vincent van Gogh. One of the things that was a surprise to me is that Vincent did a stint as a Dutch Reformed pastor. In his first and only parish, he couldn't help but see the plight of the poor coal miners. So he gave his clothing stipend to the poor. The church elders were furious. They told him in no uncertain terms that his appearance reflected directly on them. So his job was to look respectable. So they gave him more money for clothes, which he immediately passed along to the poor. So they sacked him, which drove him, out of desperation, to try and make a living painting. After all, he was a bad Christian. Love of neighbor takes risk. It means being vulnerable, annoying people, even to the point of making enemies. But if you're serious about following Jesus, it's not about obsessing over your own salvation stoking fear and policing the purity of others. It means solidarity with your neighbor. It means getting your hands in it. It means showing up in Arctic cold on a corner in Minneapolis with a whistle and your cell phone camera. It means committing yourself at a cost to your comfort, popularity, or station in life. And this is what confuses a lot of so-called good Christians, because this behavior doesn't look religious. In fact, you don't need to attend church or synagogue or mosque or follow any kind of set ritual. Loving God is much more basic, much more pedestrian and human. There are countless ways to love God, most of which have nothing to do with church and religion, and everything to do with caring for creation, forgiving wrongs done to us, leveraging change to make the world a fairer place, and taking action on behalf of those less fortunate. In the end, as Dave Tomlinson says, love is what matters. The rest is just window dressing. Some, like Columbus or many of our fellow Christians today, may be too warped and poisoned by their upbringing to even care. But for those who seek the way of Jesus, even at the cost of confusing people and being declared bad Christians, we know that reaching out to others in love is all we really need. Years ago, the fundamentalist Christian group Answers in Genesis sprang for a huge billboard in Times Square. It said, "To all of our atheist friends, thank God you're wrong." So funny. Not. It's not funny. It's not love. It's not neighborly. It's not the one thing we've been asked to be. Loving. It's ignorant. It's adolescent. It's arrogant. And it's embarrassing. It furthers the lie that Christianity is about belief, and with the genocidal maniac Columbus, prioritizes conquering the other for your own benefit. And yet, they're somehow the good Christians? As for me and my house, I'm opting for being a bad Christian. I stand with humanist Carl Sagan and godless atheists everywhere who believe, "For small creatures such as we, the vastness is bearable only through love." Paul said, "Stop fixating on the law and the commandments." Jesus couldn't care less about a person's beliefs. He asked, "You know how they'll recognize you? When they see the love you have for each other and your neighbor." Friends, putting love first is the fulfillment of the law. And love is all we ever really need. Be neighbor and be well.
Hey, and don't forget, if you like what you heard today, buy me a coffee.
Thanks, Ryan.
Anytime.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.wepuTloveFirst.org.